And Brother Wes has chosen for his subject a rather ominous title that you can see from the handout if you already have one. His title is Desolation This Day. Desolation This Day. Brother Wes.
Thank you, Brother Joe. And thank you, Brother Bob. And good afternoon, brethren. What a delight and a privilege, once again, it is for us to be with you and to share this wonderful fellowship this weekend that we've had. Wonderful lessons on the platform and off the platform, and we very much appreciated all of that. We bring the love, once again, of your brethren in the Connellsville, Pennsylvania Ecclesia, with whom we have been privileged to meet for many years. Desolation This Day is our title. And, you know, confusion has existed for well over 100 years on the meaning and the application of Israel's 70 years of desolation. We're going back a long ways in today's lesson, going back to the BC era. And not only has that confusion existed many years ago, but it also continues to our day, which is why we are taking the time to address it. Also, recently our class had a study on this subject, so we wanted to share some of the findings with you from our study from that endeavor. The concept that we're dealing today is not a minor point. As we all know, and as we've studied our chronology in our Bibles, the 70 years of desolation of Israel is a critical link in our Bible chronology. And in fact, we know that Bible chronology is really a part of the bedrock of our faith in virtually every time feature of God's plan. Now, our goal today is very simple. What is ancient Israel's 70 years of desolation? What is that? What do we mean by that? And secondly, when did it occur? Hopefully by now each of you have received a handout, which is really a summary of our remarks today. There are many texts cited there. In fact, much of that is really kind of a summary, a distillation, if you will, of the book of Jeremiah, which will be our principal focus for today. There's many texts cited there. We're not going to read or even cite most of them, but as far as the principal points of the remarks that we'll have here from the platform, we're going to follow those main points that are on that outline, but there'll be many details on there that we won't even touch on. So we really kind of offer the outline to you as a study resource if you're interested in probing the subject a bit after today's lesson. Now, the general timing for today's remarks is between 600 and 500 BC approximately. We're going to get more specific with that a little later on. The main actors in today's narrative are God, Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, and the southern or two-tribe kingdom of Judah, which we know was comprised of the tribes of Benjamin and Judah. At this point in time, we find that the two-tribe kingdom of Judah was in a very deplorable moral and religious condition. Judah had abandoned, essentially, the Old Law Covenant. They were ignoring its God-given terms. So God sent Jeremiah to encourage and to warn Judah to repent, to return to God, to return to righteousness, to return to obeying as best they could the terms of the Old Law Covenant. Jeremiah labored for a long period of time, for about 40 years, which spanned the last three kings of Judah. These three included the last 18 years of King Josiah, all 11 years of King Jehoiakim, and all 11 years of Zedekiah, the final king of Judah. Now, we find Jeremiah's stern warnings throughout his book, but we're going to focus on and use as kind of our foundation text a couple verses from Jeremiah 25, namely verses 8, 9, and 11. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, because ye have not heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith the Lord, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land, and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about, and will utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment, and an hissing, and perpetual desolations. And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Now, the context of these verses we just read is Judah's rebellious ways and God's threatened punishment on Judah. Jeremiah refers to the surrounding nations as being included in this conquest that was going to be carried out by King Nebuchadnezzar. But Judah is clearly the focus. That's Jeremiah's primary concern, is Judah. Now, Jeremiah, in these verses, refers to two main forms of punishment that he appointed God, essentially selected, God selected Nebuchadnezzar to carry out. The first form of punishment that we see here in Jeremiah 25 is directed toward the people. It's punishment toward the people in the land. And as we're going to see, this included a variety of forms of punishment, including captivity, enslavement, sickness, starvation, invasion, violent deaths, and other aspects. The second form of punishment that Jeremiah mentions in these verses was really directed toward the land in the form of desolation. This land, in verse 9, and this whole land, in verse 11, means, or at least includes, principally, the land of Judah. The word "this" in verses 9 and 11 is also important, because Jeremiah is in Judah, boots on the ground, so to speak. He's not somewhere else. He's in Judah as he's speaking. Verse 11 says that Nebuchadnezzar was to accomplish both forms of punishment for a period of 70 literal years. So the 70 years that Jeremiah mentions, it's our understanding that there's a single span of time that applies to both the punishment on the people and land desolation. So during this single span of 70 years, Nebuchadnezzar would accomplish both, primarily on this rebellious kingdom of Judah. And this brings us to one of our main questions, and that is, what is it that marks the beginning of this 70-year span of time? Here's our thesis. Here's our understanding, our proposition. The 70 years that Jeremiah is talking about began when both forms of punishment on the people and on the land first began to occur concurrently. Now, as we're going to shortly see, Nebuchadnezzar began to subjugate the Jews many years before he desolated the land. But the subjugation alone would not start the 70-year clock ticking because of what Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 25, that it would be both forms of punishment going on concurrently that would be this 70-year span. So, when did both the people's subjugation and also the land desolation first to begin to happen concurrently? Well, let's first take a look in the scriptures as to when Nebuchadnezzar began to subjugate the Jews in Judah. In verse 11 that we read, Jeremiah said that Nebuchadnezzar would cause these nations, which again, particularly and specifically, would include the kingdom of Judah, to serve him. Now, to serve here simply means to subject to, or to enslave, or to subjugate. In the book of Chronicles, the chronicler tells us that Nebuchadnezzar first attacked Judah in Jerusalem during King Jehoiakim's reign. Now, Jehoiakim, again, was the next to the last king in Judah. We find that in 2 Chronicles chapter 36. Daniel, the prophet Daniel, adds that this attack, which was really a besiegement of Jerusalem, occurred in the third year of Jehoiakim's 11-year reign. So this occurred rather early in Jehoiakim's reign. Now, besiege means to shut in. Besiege means to enclose. It means to confine. It means to surround, which simply means to control or subjugate. So Nebuchadnezzar's first attack on Judah was not for the purpose of destroying or desolating it, but rather it was for the purpose of controlling the Jewish population. So Nebuchadnezzar, in his first besiegement, took Jehoiakim and some choice prisoners, including Daniel and several others, to Babylon, along with some of the vessels of the temple. In Jeremiah 29:14, Jeremiah calls this action by Nebuchadnezzar a captivity. The Hebrew word there is shabuth, and it means prisoners, to take prisoners. After Nebuchadnezzar took Jehoiakim and Daniel and others prisoner, Nebuchadnezzar actually reinstated King Jehoiakim on the throne, but only as a vassal king, only as a subordinate king, sort of a puppet king, if you will, to Nebuchadnezzar. As a condition of his reinstatement, Jehoiakim was required to swear allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar and also to pay tribute to him. So he was clearly just a puppet king Thus Nebuchadnezzar began to subjugate or enslave Judah in the third year of Jehoiakim's 11-year reign. But we don't find any reference at this point to Nebuchadnezzar beginning to desolate the land of Judah at this point. So in the third year of Jehoiakim, the people's enslavement punishment began and continued for about 90 years after that. But the third year of Jehoiakim's reign did not begin the 70 years of desolation because the desolation portion of the punishment had not yet begun. So this leaves us with the question of when did Jeremiah's predicted 70 years of land desolation of Judah begin? Well, we think in order to understand Judah's desolation and when it began, we first need to understand what is desolation. What do we mean by that? What did Jeremiah mean? Jeremiah actually uses three different Hebrew words, predominantly three. There's more than that, but there's predominantly three different Hebrew words that he uses that are translated desolate or desolation. But they all mean ruin, they mean devastation, they mean waste. Okay, that's helpful, that's a start, but really it doesn't really give us much of a picture, a clear understanding of still what does desolation mean. So let's proceed to consider several of Jeremiah's desolation prophecies to see exactly how Jeremiah is using the term desolate or desolation. But before we actually launch into that, let's talk about three preliminary observations about the man Jeremiah and his prophecies. First of all, God sent Jeremiah personally to deliver to Judah, first of all, the encouragements to repent, and then if they didn't repent, also the warnings, the threats of punishment. Jeremiah was personally present to both deliver and also witness the fulfillment of his prophecies to Judah. You know, oftentimes one prophet will give a prophecy and it won't be fulfilled until long after that prophet is off the scene. But here, unusually, Jeremiah was given the prophecies and he was also kept in the land long enough to actually witness the complete fulfillment of these prophecies that he was talking about relative to Judah, natural Israel. So Judah is not, Jeremiah here is not writing as a history student. He's not reporting to us what he heard somebody else say or what someone else told him, but he's speaking to us as an eyewitness. He's delivered, he delivers the warning, he witnesses its fulfillment. Eyewitness testimony from a faithful servant or prophet of God is powerful, compelling, and it's irrefutable. So our second preliminary point is that the book of Jeremiah, if you just read it like a novel, it kind of jumps around because it's not structured in a strict chronological sequence. However, we're going to suggest today in our remarks that the book of Jeremiah nicely subdivides itself into five different parts, five relevant parts to our subject, which we will present or attempt to present in sequence. Our third preliminary point is that much of Jeremiah's testimony was written poetically, not as plain speech. Now, poetry sometimes is a little hard to decipher. You have to think about it more. But poetry is powerful because it was meant to go beyond just touching the head. Poetry is meant to touch the heart. It's meant to touch us deeply. And that's what God wanted to do with Judah, to touch their hearts. The first part of Jeremiah's five-part testimony that we talked about is him telling Judah about their unfaithfulness. Jeremiah told Judah that their waywardness all stems back in one form or another to their repeated breach of the old law covenant, doing things that were contrary to what Judah had agreed to do with God as a part of that covenant. Examples: they worshiped heathen gods, they worshiped idols, they violated the sacred Sabbath, they neglected to care for the needy, they neglected to care for the aliens, the orphans, the widows. They engaged in a pattern, a habit of lying and deceit. They committed both national prostitution as well as individual prostitution. They committed national adultery as well as individual adultery. They sacrificed their children to Baal, which has already been mentioned from this platform this weekend. They refused to free their Hebrew bondmen every 7 years. All these things and others were a direct violation of the old law covenant. The second part of Jeremiah's testimony, in addition to telling them what they've been doing wrong, was, of course, his testimony over a period of 40 years, urging them to repent, change their ways. Jeremiah repeatedly counseled them, repeatedly implored them, Judah, correct your ways. But they ignored Jeremiah's warnings, and instead Judah continued to walk in her own willful way. And moreover, not only did they just walk in their own willful way, but they persecuted. You know, it's one thing to hate the message, but it's another thing to persecute the messenger, which is exactly what they did. They beat Jeremiah personally. They burned his scroll, which were contained the warnings that he was directed to give them. He was imprisoned multiple times. He was thrown into a filthy dungeon on one occasion. On another occasion, he's thrown into a dark, muddy cistern. He's put in chains at one point. So despite his warnings, they obviously didn't react very well. The third part of Jeremiah's testimony was his repeated forecasts of the dire consequences that were going to occur to Judah if they failed to repent. Over and over again throughout the book of Jeremiah, we see that he announced the inevitable consequences of Judah's refusal to change. And with each succeeding act of disobedience and rebellion by Judah, the punishment intensity increased. We might paraphrase God's perspective on the progression of Judah's disobedience and warnings something like this: Judah, despite my many warnings, you steadfastly refuse to repent. You steadfastly refuse to obey me. You refuse to stop violating your covenant. You prefer the ways of the heathen. That's the ways that you have adopted. So you prefer the ways of the heathen so much, I'm going to deliver you over to them. First, I'm going to let them invade you. They're going to dominate and subjugate you. Some of you are even going to starve. Some of you will die. They will kill many of you. And most of the rest of you are going to be taken to go live with them. You like them so much, I'm going to let you just go live with them. Finally, I'm going to let them desolate your land, your cities, your whole land, so that not only won't you live there, you can't live there. So let's take a closer look now at some of Jeremiah's desolation forecast testimony. Now, this is only the forecast. This is not the fulfillment. We'll come back to that in a few moments. Jeremiah 9:11, and I will make Jerusalem heaps and a den of dragons, and I will make the cities of Judah desolate without an inhabitant. So here we see that Judah's capital city was going to be made desolate, Jerusalem. But the desolation doesn't stop here, as we see, with just that one city. All the cities of Judah would be demolished. No inhabitants, nobody home. The NIV reads, no one can live there, meaning not just deserted, but uninhabitable because it's been destroyed. Let's go to Jeremiah 21, verses 3 and 10. There we read, then said Jeremiah unto them, thus shall ye say to Zedekiah, for I have set my face against this city for evil and not for good, saith the Lord. It shall be given into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall burn it with fire. Now Jeremiah delivered this prediction to King Zedekiah during his last 2 years of the reign while Nebuchadnezzar had the city of Jerusalem under siege. So it was during this last 2-year siege by Nebuchadnezzar that Jerusalem was not burned with fire. It was under siege, but it was not yet burned with fire. It would be at the end of this 2-year siege, as we're going to see, that Nebuchadnezzar would actually burn the city to the ground. Chapter 22, verses 1, 5, and 7. Thus saith the Lord, go down to the house of the king of Judah and speak there this word. But if ye, this is Zedekiah, will not hear these words, I will swear by myself, saith the Lord, that this house shall become a desolation, and I will prepare destroyers against thee, one every one with his weapons, and they shall cut down thy choice cedars and cast them into the fire. Now, this prophecy we find in Jeremiah 22 is about Nebuchadnezzar destroying the king's palace. He's going here and he's giving a message to King Zedekiah. This is Zedekiah's palace that he's talking about. This is Zedekiah's personal residence that we're dealing with here, his house. King Jehoiakim, the previous king, was the one that actually built this palace, but he built it based on injustice. He built it based on oppression. you know, under the old law covenant, the king of Israel was actually to protect the population from oppression. But here we find that Jehoiakim actually built this magnificent kingly palace in which the kings lived, built it with forced and illegal Hebrew slave labor. So God isolated on, and he highlighted the destruction of what he called, or what he characterized, as this icon of evil practices of the kings of Judah. These beautiful cedar beams in the palace were to be dismantled from the palace and then incinerated as a part of the desolation. Chapter 34. The word came, which came unto Jeremiah from the Lord, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army, and all the kingdoms of the earth of his dominion, and all the people fought against Jerusalem, and against all the cities thereof, saying, Then Jeremiah the prophet spake all these words unto Zedekiah, king of Judah in Jerusalem, Behold, I will command, saith the Lord, and cause them to return to the city, and they shall fight against it, and take it, and burn it with fire, and I will make the cities of Judah a desolation without an inhabitant. At this point in the prophecy, again, King Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, is still on the throne, but not for long. He's got less than 2 years to go. At this point, Nebuchadnezzar has Jerusalem under attack. He's already destroyed the other cities of Judah, except for two, as we learned there in verse 7. At this point, the men of Judah are at war with Nebuchadnezzar. But the men of Judah are still in Judah. They are still in the land, but they're there battling Nebuchadnezzar's army. Even at this advanced point in the war, we notice here that Jeremiah says that the desolation is future. It hasn't happened yet. It's not yet occurred. And it's not going to occur until all the cities of Judah are without an inhabitant and made uninhabitable. Let's go to the fourth part of Jeremiah's testimony. This is his eyewitness account of the fulfillment of this predicted desolation. We're going to go to and read a couple of verses from Jeremiah chapter 39. 39, 1 and 2. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army against Jerusalem, and they besieged it. And in the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, the ninth day of the month, the city was broken up. Here we see it was in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign that Nebuchadnezzar surrounds the city of Jerusalem, and he puts this stranglehold on the city of Jerusalem. This was in the ninth year. If we go fast forward just a slightly, Jeremiah is saying here, in the 11th year, which was in the last year of Zedekiah's reign, the Jews in Jerusalem were literally starving. They were weak. They hadn't been besieged. They had, you know, Nebuchadnezzar had cut off the supply lines, and that had occurred in the ninth year, and now we're in the 11th year. So Jerusalem's defenses now are weakened. So Nebuchadnezzar then easily breaks through the walls of Jerusalem. This is in the 11th year, early in the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign. He breaks through the walls. He then kills or takes the remaining Jews to Babylon, and he burns the city to the ground. Note here that this occurred in the fourth and the fifth month of Zedekiah's 11th year. So this is about halfway through Zedekiah's 11th year, or this last year of his reign, that this demolishment of the city of Jerusalem occurs. Now, Nebuchadnezzar did leave a few what we call vine dressers in the land, what we call the vine dressers or the remnant in Judah. But even this was only a temporary condition. Note here that Jeremiah was temporarily left in Judah. Jeremiah was never taken to Babylon, ever, at least according to the account. He stayed in Judah as an eyewitness. Very important point for us to recall and keep in our minds. If we look at chapters 41, 42, and 43 in Jeremiah, we find that Jeremiah tells us what happened to the remnant of Jews that were left behind in Judah. They were either killed, or they fled east to Ammon, which would today be modern-day Jordan, or they fled south to Egypt. Now, before the remnant that ended up going to Egypt, before they left to go to Egypt, Jeremiah instructed them this remnant, this portion of the remnant, to stay in Judah. But just like they had already done before, they refused. They called Jeremiah a liar because Jeremiah said, look, if you stay here, you're going to be safe. They said, you're lying to us. So we're going to Egypt. We're not taking a chance on getting killed here by Nebuchadnezzar by staying in the land. So as rebels, they went on down to Egypt. Jeremiah 43:7. So they, talking about this remnant of Jews, came into the land of Egypt, for they obeyed not the voice of the Lord. They came even to Tahpanhes, which is generally down in the Nile Delta area. So here in this verse, we see that they leave Judah, and they actually go down and enter into Egypt. God sent Jeremiah to Egypt with this remnant because Jeremiah, we believe, was to continue as a prophet, as an encouragement to them, and also as a warning, a source of warning, and also as our eyewitness as to exactly what happened and when. So after this remnant, this final remnant of Jews, went to Egypt, Jeremiah told them that Nebuchadnezzar would destroy Egypt and the remnant would die. So they weren't going to get away from death anyway by going to Egypt. Once they were in Egypt, Jeremiah makes a critical declaration to the final remnant that rebelliously went to Egypt. And we find this in chapter 44, verses 2 and 22. Jeremiah 44, 2 and 22. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, ye have seen all the evil that I have brought upon Jerusalem and upon all the cities of Judah. And behold, this day they are a desolation, and no man dwelleth therein. So that the Lord could no longer bear, we're in verse 22 now, so that the Lord could no longer bear because of the evil of your doings and because of the abominations which ye have committed, therefore is your land a desolation and an astonishment and a curse without an inhabitant as at this day. These verses, we understand, record the official beginning. This is God's declaration through the prophet Jeremiah as to the beginning of the predicted 70 years of desolation. The final remnant of Jews had vacated the land of Judah, and they had fled to and they had arrived in Egypt. The flight to Egypt was in the seventh month of the 11th year, which is the last year of Zedekiah's reign. So this is toward the latter part of the reign of the 11th year of King Zedekiah's reign that we find this remnant have gone to Egypt. And Jeremiah makes this critical declaration. It was not until Jeremiah and this remnant that fled to Egypt were in Egypt that God's witness then declares the official beginning of Judah's desolation. Notice in chapter 44, verses 2 and 6, they both read, behold, this day, not yesterday, not last month, not last year, but this day, they, talking about Judah, the cities of Judah, are a desolation. Verse 22 says, therefore is your land a desolation. So here we find that Jeremiah references the fact of the beginning of this desolation when the remnant is gone. They've either been killed, they've been taken to Babylon, they've gone to Jordan, or they've fled to Egypt. It's not until all of that occurs that he says, behold, and he says it not once, he says it not twice, but he says it three times in verses 2, 6, and 22, therefore is your land a desolation. So Jeremiah makes this declaration after Zedekiah is removed from the throne, but it's still within that last year of the 11th, the 11th year of his reign. So, in short, we find that God's eyewitness says that the 70 years of desolation did not occur until the end, toward the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign. Now, Jeremiah is not the only witness that we have to tell us about the desolation of Judah, because God has given us at least five additional corroborating witnesses. And these are identified for you on your outline. So if you look at sections 5.1 through 5.5 on your outline, we there have reference to the Kings, the Chronicles, Daniel, Zechariah, and Moses. Now, each of these five, what we're calling corroborating witnesses, tell us the same story as Jeremiah as to what desolation means and when it occurred. The united testimony of these five corroborating witnesses is that desolation means two things. It means, first of all, that the land of Judah is uninhabited, there's nobody home. And secondly, it means that the land is uninhabitable because the infrastructure has been destroyed. That did not occur, as we see the account of Jeremiah's own eyewitness account, that did not occur until the latter part of Zedekiah's 11 years of reign. After Nebuchadnezzar had dethroned him, after the people were gone from the land, and the Judean cities, and even, yes, the rural areas, you'll read in some of the verses we did not quote, even some of the rural areas were literally reduced to rubble. And it existed for a period of 70 years, which we believe was from 606 BC until King Cyrus's decree that allowed Jews to return to begin rebuilding their temple in 536. Now, for purposes of today's remarks, we limit our consideration of these five corroborating witnesses to just one, and that's the testimony of Moses. Arguably, Moses' testimony is the most important of all the corroborating witnesses because Moses tells us why the 70 years. Why not 80? Why not 90? Why not 50? Why not some other number? Why 70? Moses gives us the reason. And understanding why God wanted Eretz Israel rendered desolate further helps us to understand what desolation means and what had to happen in order for this condition to actually be achieved in Judah. Now, you're saying, how could Moses be a corroborating witness to Jeremiah when in fact Moses lived 1,000 years before Jeremiah? Well, in actuality, Jeremiah's desolation prophecy was probably based on Moses. But we're calling, for purposes of today's lesson, Moses a corroborating witness because he's telling us why the 70 years desolation was the prophecy of the prophet Jeremiah. And let's look at Leviticus 26, verses 33 to 35. We're just going to read these in part. 26 of Leviticus now, 33 to 35. Moses says there, your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. Then shall the land, the Eretz, enjoy her Sabbath as long as it lieth desolate. As long as it lieth desolate. And ye shall be in your enemy's land. Even then shall the land rest and enjoy her Sabbath. As long as it lieth desolate, it shall rest, because it did not rest in your Sabbath when ye dwelt upon it. Moses gives us the reason for the 70. God designed that there would be 70 jubilee cycles that would exist from the time that Israel entered the land until the time of the Lord's return. This was God's measuring stick. He was going to measure it in terms of jubilee cycles, and there was going to be 70 of them, was his design. Moses tells us that the rebellious Jews did not keep a single jubilee properly, or in some cases, not at all. Because in some cases, they were not even in the land. But they didn't even keep them perfectly while they were in the land. Now, how is it that you keep a rebellious people? How do you make them? How do you make sure that that land enjoys its Sabbath when you got a bunch of rebels in the land that don't pay any attention to the rules? Well, there's only one effective way to make sure that a disobedient and rebellious people gives the land its proper rest. And what is that? What is that technique? You remove the rebels from the land, and you make it so that they can't live there. Not only take them out, but make it so that they can't even live there, even if they wanted to. So vacate the land and make it uninhabitable. That's how you guarantee 70 perfect jubilees. And that was God's plan. Merely enslaving the people while they were in the land wasn't going to fulfill God's jubilee design. subjugating the people while they were still in the land was not going to constitute a year of Jubilee land rest. But removing all the people from the land and rendering that land uninhabitable certainly does create a Jubilee year. So if you're bringing the people out of the land and rendering it uninhabitable, it makes it impossible for this bunch of rebels to refuse or neglect to carry out the Jubilee years, because they're not there to violate them. The land is going to get its rest. Jeremiah said, as we kind of draw our lesson to a close, Jeremiah said that the people of Judah would be punished with both subjugation and land desolation for a concurrent period of 70 years. Desolation means two conditions, which we've mentioned: rendering the land uninhabited and uninhabitable. Jeremiah not only referred to Judah's desolation, he described it in great detail, of which we've only looked at a few verses. Others are on your outline. But he describes this condition of desolation in great detail throughout the book of Jeremiah. Desolation does not mean enslaving or subjugating the Jewish people while they are still in the land. That's not desolation. Desolation means removing the people from the land and destroying their ability to live there, making Judah uninhabited and uninhabitable for 70 years is what it would take to give the land its proper 70 years of rest that God designed. And we know that desolation occurred in the end of Zedekiah's 11th year, because that's when Jeremiah was there in Egypt after everyone has gone from the land and the cities are destroyed and even the rural areas. It's not until Jeremiah is in Egypt with that final remnant that he declares, not once, not twice, but three times, that now is the official beginning of desolation. It was in 606 BC that Jeremiah was in Egypt. He was there as an eyewitness, and he declares that desolation had officially begun in Judah. We believe the scriptural evidence is clear that the 70 years of desolation began in 606 and it ended in 536. Now, the claim that the 70 years began any earlier than this, which is a claim that's been made for well over 100 years, we find that that claim is really not as we're enabled to find. We do not find that it is scripturally supportable. We realize there are different concepts, there are different perspectives on this, and our view is, like Brother David said yesterday, our view is not to convince or to make anyone uncomfortable, but after looking at all the scriptural evidence, we believe that the 70 years of desolation began in 606 and ended in 536. But given the fact that there are different perspectives on this, our attitude is that of the Apostle Paul in Romans 14:11. When he says, one man esteemeth one day above another, another esteemeth every day alike, let every man be persuaded in his own mind.